guess I should be very honored. I see you, Jara, came directly to my... From Europe, directly to my talk. So... It's a black. It's actually going to be Blackboard talk mainly. So I just tested this because I want to show some results of experiments along the way, and there is a nice title, so you can all see the title. So what is going to be my focus today? So actually, Thierry's talk yesterday gave a great promo to my talk by showing these beautiful pictures from Dalibard's experiment. And maybe this is, I don't need too much introduction why it's interesting to look at interference between condensates. So my point today will be, first of all, I want to show you, everybody agrees now that if you have two perfect condensates, you get a perfect interference pattern with contrast one in principle. And Peter Zoller talked about it in his review talk. From the point of view suggested some time ago by Dalibard and Ivan Castan, I want to present a different point of view of looking at the same thing that will help us go to some more complicated cases like fluctuating condensates in one dimension and in two dimension, interacting condensates. So that will be the first thing I want to do. I want to show a very simple way of understanding why perfect condensates give a perfect interference pattern even if they didn't know about each other before the interference. And then I want to generalize it to slightly more complicated cases. And in the second part of the talk, so all of this would be independent condensates, basically condensates that have never known each other. Then I'll talk about dependent condensates, and I'll talk about condensates that basically are originating from the same condensate that has been split coherently into two, and ask the question, how does the well-defined phase between the two condensates that was basically imposed by the initial conditions goes away as a function of time because of fluctuations and interactions in the system. I'll argue that if there were no interactions, at least at zero temperature and without any interference from the outside world, the condensates would remain in phase all the time. So this is the plan. And
the other thing you call dephasing? Or?
I'll call dephasing. I don't know if it's the correct term for that, but I'll define exactly what I mean. What is the operator that we're looking at and how it goes away?
And it's a loss of interference.
It's loss of basically, it's not the loss of the interference necessarily, but it's loss of the well-defined or deterministic phase. Because when you start with two condensates that have been split coherently, you know that the phase between the condensates is going to be zero or very close to zero. And I'll define it very well that what I mean by the phase going away, but then if you wait for some time, you do an experiment, you just don't know what the phase is going to be. And if you plot a distribution of the phases, it's going to be completely uniform after some time. And the question is how long it takes for the distribution of phase to become uniform. That is what I call dephasing, okay? So let me start from very, very simple things. Well, actually, it will all be very, very simple things. There will be nothing fancy here in this talk. But this is really, really simple, what I'm starting from, because I'm starting from two condensates that are, each of them has just one mode, just a single mode, and this mode is macroscopically occupied. So in principle, we can write the wave function. So this will be condensate, say, They're separated a distance d apart. This will be condensate 1, and this will be condensate 2. And let's call this coordinate here x. Okay, so they're expanding. And I want to see, so they're expanding everywhere, but I want, and maybe even falling. But I'm going to follow their flight. And I want to know what is the density distribution that I observe when they fall in a single experiment.
The initial state of these condensates is a Fock state.
Yeah, I'm going to write it down exactly. So since it's two perfect condensates and they're a single mode, each of them has a macroscopic occupation, so it's just a Fock state. So the initial state is n particles here, n particles in one, n particles in two, which I can also write up to normalization, a dagger to the power n, a dagger 2 to the power n. Okay, so acting on the vacuum, of course. Okay, now we want to know what we'll see. And the problem with this is that we're going to do a single experiment, and actually, usually in quantum mechanics, and especially in condensed matter, we are used to measuring expectation values. Here, we're going to do a single experiment, and a single experiment does not measure necessarily an expectation value. So let's start out by writing the operator of what we think we are seeing, which is the density after a time of light. So in order to write this in a simple way, I want to write the boson field operator acting on the state after, so it's when it's acting on the state after expansion, or maybe it's bad notation, should write this as phi, acting on phi at time t, or actually at time zero, because the density after time of light, we can, instead of evolving the state, we can evolve the field operator. And we want to know how it acts on the state. And it acts on the state exactly like the operator e to the I k1 x a1 plus e to the I k2 x a2, where k1 and k2 are the phases accumulated over the ballistic expansion up to the point x. So, and you can actually write, after a long time of light, I mean, you can actually write k1 and 2 as x plus minus d over 2 over h bar over t m. Okay, so this just reflects the fact that the field operator acting on the wave function after expansion is very much constrained, because we know that the boson originally came either from point 2 or from point 1. It could not have originated from anywhere else in space. So actually, all this is, of course, multiplied by some wave function, initial wave function that expands. So it's probably going to be some Gaussian that expands. So.
But that's why I don't understand this expression now, phi is 0. So.
That's acting on.
Do we apply psi to phi of 0 or phi of t?
No. Okay.
Phi of 0 is the same as phi, right?
Right. So it's either you apply time independent operators, right, at point x to the expanded wave function at point t, or you can apply the time dependence to the operators in the Heisenberg representation, but then you have to take this at time zero. And that's much more convenient to think about it in that way, because you know that when this is acting on this, of course, this operator contains all the field operators when it acts on the initial state, we know that the initial state contained only a boson here or a boson here. So it's much more convenient to write it like that. But okay, I'm not going to go into subtleties that will turn out to be important if you're interested in shot noise. But if you're not interested in shot noise, you don't have to worry about this. I deliberately wrote this as acting on the wave function in the sense that this is not equal to this operator. It is only equal to this operator when it is acting as an annihilation operator on the ground state, and that's why on the initial state, and that's why you always have to worry about normal ordering of these operators. You first have to normal order your actual operator you're measuring. With density operator, it's no problem because it's already normal ordered. If you're measuring some n squared, for example, density squared, you'll first have to normal order it and then write it in this way. So, okay, so.
Can you elaborate on what?
So for example, density squared is psi dagger, psi dagger, psi dagger, psi dagger. So now I'm allowed to write this operator as a1 plus a2. Only if it's not going to be important for what I'm doing, but you have to do that if I'm evaluating such an expectation value, this operator does not act like that because it's only this identity is only an identity of acting on the ground state, right? Because the fact that otherwise this operator has to be expanded in its full, completely. It's not just it's an operator. It's not a wave function. But when it acts,
A1, A2 are also operators, aren't they?
Yeah, they're operators. Yeah, but but the identity between this and A1 and A2 is correct only when you act on the ground state. Why is it just A1 and A2? Not in principle, you'd have to expand it in terms of all the operators at time zero, everywhere in space. But if you're acting on the ground state, but this thing is not acting on the ground state because it's already acting on something else. Okay, so you first have to normal order and then do that. So I'm just being careful but I'm not going to use it because all of this normal ordering will turn out to give lower orders of the number of particles. So if we're not interested in short noise, then it doesn't matter. Okay, so, but.
And also A1, A2, I should think of as a k equals 0 component of each condensate.
Yeah, but I'm considering, let's make it simple, and the condensates are just point-like now. Okay.
I know, just you're calling them condensates, okay, but then you're calling them condensates, but in that case, it would be pure Fock state, so how is it?
It's a Fock state. It's a condensate in the sense that you have n is macroscopic. I think that n is going to be something of order more than a million particles, and so I'm going to neglect, that's why I'm going to neglect shot noise, I'm going to neglect fluctuations of order square root of n are going to be neglected. So this is a macroscopic occupation of a single particle state. In that sense, it's a condensate. And I want to show that this entails automatically a well-defined interference pattern. And in that sense, it's also a condensate. Okay, so that's what I'm going to show you. Okay, so let's write the density operator, psi dagger. Psi of x and t. So I just have to square this guy appropriately, and it's going to be a dagger 1 a1 plus a dagger 2 a2 delta k is going to be d m over h bar t a dagger 1 a 2 plus Hermitian conjugate of that. This is the operator which we call the density, and presumably we're measuring. So I'm going to warn you in advance that it's not so clear if we're measuring an expectation value of this operator, but let's just for fun, calculate the expectation value of this operator. So we have to put an expectation value everywhere. This will give us 2n. But here, because we assume that, we assume that the condensates do not know each other. There is no correlation between the condensates. So this has to be zero. But this is also clear from the fact that we just put a Fock state here. That means that there is no expectation value of a dagger 1, a 2, no coherence between the condensates. So that's going to be odd. There is, although this term looks very nice like an interference pattern, when we are taking an expectation value, we don't see an interference pattern. So now the question is it really true that there is not supposed to be an interference pattern? And, well, the answer to that has to do with the fact that, as I said, we're not necessarily measuring an expectation value. And how do we know whether we're measuring an expectation value in quantum mechanics? Well, we're never measuring a true expectation value. But when something is very large, often it has a self-averaging property. A self-averaging property means that if we're measuring some operator A and the fluctuation from the expectation value is very small in some sense, if here it goes away in the thermodynamic limit, it means that we're actually measuring an expectation value. So let's check for the operator rho that we think we're measuring whether the fluctuation is small in some sense in the thermodynamic limit. So let's measure this fluctuation, which will be delta rho x. So let's call this delta rho, right? Because it's rho minus rho average. So delta rho x, delta rho y, delta rho x prime, say, this is the fluctuation of this operator. And what we have to do is just, you know, take the usual square this, and we get e to the I. So let's call all this, just so I don't have to, let's call this k naught here. So this is going to be e to the I k naught x minus x prime, a dagger 1, a2 dagger a1, average.
Is there an x in the
exponent? Yeah, x, of course. Yeah. I probably erased it, but yeah, of course. And now there is, so now you square this. There are several ways you can do that. You can do that taking, squaring just this term. Well, not squaring, a dagger, take, just square this term. And that would give you something like a dagger 1, a dagger 1, a2. Expectation value, but of course in this state this is zero, okay, because it's a Fock state. But this expectation value is not zero. Actually, you can see what it is exactly. It's n times n plus 1. And since I'm not going to worry about lower powers of n because n is macroscopic, I'm just going to write n squared times cosine k naught x minus x prime. So immediately you see that this fluctuation is of the same. So you take square root of that is the fluctuation. It's of order n, while this thing is also of order n. So the fluctuation is large, and of course we're not measuring this. Next thing you notice is that when you look at this, this is the correlation function, density-density correlation between point x and point x prime. And in fact, Let me call this operator a dagger 1, a 2. Let's call it A, because it's going to be the amplitude of the interference pattern, okay? We're going to use it a lot. So this looks like the amplitude of the interference pattern squared times some interference, okay? So if we're really going to measure, so that's, that seems to be what we're measuring. But we have to be careful again, because this A, this amplitude of the interference pattern, is yet again a quantum operator. So it's not clear if we're really measuring this in every experiment. So we have to check this by calculating A squared average minus A squared average squared, which is the fluctuation of this quantity, and take root 1/4 of that, and that will be equal, up to shot noise terms, it will be equal to, we have to take this operator and write it 4 times, so something like a dagger 1, a1, A2, A dagger 2, there's going to be 2 A dagger 1s, 2 A1s, 2 A dagger 2s, and A2, and since, and any commutation relations will only introduce lower powers of n, so it does, the commutation relations are not important here, which is actually the essence of this whole thing, times a minus a average squared, which is n, this a average squared is this n squared that we found before, square it, it's n to the power 4, And if we calculate this, we see also n squared coming from here and n squared coming from here. So there is no, this just cancels. So this is zero. Plus, actually, there will be orders of n, n3. Well, I didn't take the exp. So all this has to be, you have to take a root of that, and then you'll see that there will not be any term larger than square root of n. So when you take one quarter root of that. So, okay, so I think what I did here is prove to you that if you look at this operator without the expectation value, it's the same as measuring just the expectation value. So an experimentalist getting, say, some pattern can actually measure this operator. How can you measure this operator? Basically measure, take two points and take the, multiply the densities, he sees at these two points, or the offsets of the densities in these two points, and do it once, do it in the next experiment, do it in another experiment, and my point is that it will always be the same. It will always be this without any fluctuation in the thermodynamic limit. And that is the source of seeing this sharp interference pattern, which has a full contrast, which is of order n, so we see an oscillation. That means that we'll see an oscillation. Every time we'll see an oscillation in the density with amplitude n, and just the phase is completely undetermined, right? Because this correlation function just tells us about the distance x minus x prime. It doesn't tell us where this oscillation starts in space. Okay, so.
What is there? I don't dispute that. It's perfectly okay. But this is quantum mechanics.
So yeah.
If one starts from the wave function and you give the experimental procedure, in principle, there is no metaphysical doubt on what you should measure in the experiment. You said it's not obvious when measures an expectation value or blah blah blah. But I mean, again, if you do quantum mechanics, you know exactly what is the procedure.
Well, I did quantum
one time.
I'm doing a single measurement. So doing a single measurement, I'm not, usually you're thinking in quantum mechanics of doing many measurements and averaging over many measurements. Now I'm not doing many measurements. I'm doing a single measurement and I want to see whether this single measurement reflects some correlation function, which means doing an average over many experiments. And I'm showing that this single experiment does not, it's actually trivial, all of this is trivial, but that doing this single experiment does not reflect the density, the average of the density over many experiments, because that would be zero, or will have no fluctuating part, no oscillating part, but it does reflect this density-density correlation function, because this is almost an eigenstate of the system. Okay, so this density-density correlation function. Okay, so.
So I guess the claim is in a single measurement, because of self-averaging, it's really also an average measurement, even in a single measurement. Is that?
Yes.
Because the n is large.
Yes. But not everything is self-averaging. So density is not self-averaging. What I showed you is that this density-density correlation is self-averaging.
But can you measure this in a one-shot experiment?
Yes, so that's exactly what I'm saying, that this is what you will see in a one-shot.
What would you do? I mean,
oh, that's what I'm saying. No, but first of all, what I'm saying is that this implies this, actually, in one-shot experiment. But if you want to be more formal, then the experimentalist, of course, can measure this, because you have the density, the instantaneous density everywhere, right? So you can just take at any point x and x prime, and maybe if you want to make this translationally invariant, integrate over x and look at the distance x minus x prime, right? So you can do that. You have this profile, then you can take rho of x here times rho of x prime at this point x prime, and just say shift it all the time, and you measure this in a single experiment, and you find some answer, and the answer is going to be this cosine as a function of the distance between the two points you found. And my claim is that you're going to get the same answer every time, which means that you basically get every time such an oscillation of the density. Okay, so the reason why I like this way of thinking about it, because it somehow is not so dependent, it doesn't seem that it's dependent on the way you do the measurement, contrary to this way that Dalibard and Castan have to think about it, that you have to eject the atoms one by one somehow and measure them one by one, which is probably correct, and probably you can map any measurement scheme to this kind of measurement. But this, anyways, is you see that you can get the answers immediately very, very, very nicely. You don't have to do any kind of simulation in order to get it. So,
I always wonder about this thing, whether it's really, whether it's quantum mechanical, the variation in the phase, or are these quantum fluctuations? And what I really mean is that, another way of doing this calculation is you can write this Fock state as a coherent state,
yes,
where you average over phase, and then you can show fairly easily that any expectation value of any operators in the leading, in the large N,
yeah,
approximation, can just be written as an average over the phase of,
yeah,
the expectation value for each value of the phase. So in other words, it's a classical phase, a distribution of a classical distribution of phase. And so analogously, in this sort of symmetry breaking language, the reason why the density isn't self-averaging is because one should introduce a set of ensembles parameterized by different phases and then do averages over those and this kind of thing. But those were classical ideas. In fact, the whole idea of symmetry breaking is in some way,
yeah,
classical, because it's a hidden variable theory. We produce a classical probability distribution that's kind of a result.
Yeah.
So I always wondered if there was some way of actually
distinguishing. So basically, I guess maybe to say, I'm not sure I understood everything, but I think to put in simple words, maybe, can we distinguish two coherent states that were somehow coherent somehow there was someone prepared it for you, but in a random phase, between this Fock state that did not have a state? So the answer is, from this kind of measurement, without considering shot noise, you cannot. Turns out that if you measure the shot noise, so actually Anatoly Polkovnikov has a paper just about this, and it turns out that if you measure the shot noise of these two kinds of states, so there is sub-leading corrections to this, and the sub-leading correction is exactly, parametrically exactly the same, but has a different prefactor. So it would be very, very hard, but you could.
Well,
the other one is two coherent states that were prepared with a random phase. Yeah. So it turns out that from the shot noise, you could barely distinguish them, but it would be very hard. So it is, in some sense, an academic question.
The distinction between them is that, here n is completely fixed,
right,
and there's a grand fluctuation.
So in some sense, this is almost a classical state, and the only thing that distinguishes it from classical state is these shot noise corrections, which, as I told you, have to involve commutation relations. So in some sense, the fact that I didn't have to do any commutation relations to get this, and I have to be careful if I want to get the shot noise, tells you that you are going to get the difference there.
I always wondered if you could imagine a sort of experiment. If you want to do like a bell type experiment where you need more axes, if you like, to look along.
Yeah.
To tell. Maybe in a spinner condenser, I always wondered where. But I guess with this thing where you only got phase, you can't.
Yeah, because it's so classical, then, yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Isn't the only thing which matters is short noise speed? Because imagine that you have a coherent state initially.
Yeah.
And the Hamiltonian has a quadratic part and fourth power part.
Yeah, yes.
Interaction.
Oh, between the two condensates.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm considering a completely separated and independent condensates.
Yeah, but within each condensate, is there an interaction present or not?
I don't know. I don't want to get into that now. I'll get into dynamics and interactions later, but now I don't want to get in. I'm just talking about states and whether you could distinguish two states from each other. So if there is an interaction, that would be, if you wait some time, things will happen, right? But if I prepare these in two states, then it doesn't matter if there is an interaction. I want to just prepare states and then measure them. Okay, so interaction doesn't.
This a little bit bothers me because, there is a long standing discussion of what is the phase spreading. It starts from 1980 or something.
I'm going to talk about this here. So that's the second part. This is what I call dephasing, phase spreading. I'm going to talk about this carefully, I think. So,
okay. Then I'm
so maybe ask it there. Okay, so here I'm not talking about phase spreading, only about, suppose you're given states, do you see an interference pattern or not? Okay, so I know the ground state, I'm in the ground state, or I was in some prepared state, and I want to measure them. Okay, so step by step. Now, I want to generalize this to, actually, maybe now to move a little bit faster, I'll show you, because it's a very, very similar formalism, only now taking the condensates to be one-dimensional. Maybe it'll go a little bit faster if I don't write on the board. So it makes me a little tired, but so if you prefer the board at some point or want to ask a question, then I'll go back to the board. But if it works, yeah. Okay, so now I'm going to consider two condensates. Is it? See?
I think it's part of that.
What? It's coming back. So there is a nice analogy. What's that? It's not. It's warming. Okay, so we're considering two condensates, and we have a screen. We have a screen here. These, now instead of point condensates, you have long condensates. They could even be two-dimensional out of the plane, and you have a beam that comes, a beam of light that integrates through the density profile that occurs after expansion, and this integration you see here. So if there is an interference pattern, you see this interference pattern here on the screen. Another experimental way here. So this is the imaging beam, and it makes sense to first just to understand what will happen to consider these as just just point condensates along two chains, okay? And this beam now integrates, and each of these point condensates, as I showed you before, gives you a perfect interference pattern because it's a point condensate, and it has this perfect interference pattern with a random phase, as we showed. So now, this beam integrates over many such such phases. So there's many phases, but they could be different from one condensate to the next. And now we have two possibilities. If all these condensates are perfectly aligned with each other, so these condensates are all talking with one another and have the same phase exactly, but they have a random phase compared to these condensates, then all of these phases are the same. So we just have to add them. It's like adding arrows with the same direction. They just add up to the length of the condensate. And the fringe contrast we get is just amplified by the number of these little interference patterns we had to go through. So it just scales like L, okay? So, and the fluctuation in the fringe average is zero, because there is, you know, every time you'll just have to add them all up together, and the magnitude of this vector is always going to be the same. Now there is going to be you can have also a different situation where along the chain you have completely uncorrelated phases. So if you have completely uncorrelated phases along the chain, it's like a random walk, right? So each phase it's a random walk in two dimensions, and we know everything about random walks, and the length of this vector of the amplitude of interference pattern is going to be just this persistent length of the two-dimensional polynomial, which scales like the like square root of L, like the square root of the number of arrows we had to add in this random walk. Okay, and actually we know all about the statistical properties of this, and it's going to be completely Poissonian. Actually, okay, so for example, the next moment will also be square root of L, and also all the next moments are going to be square root of L. So these are two limiting examples. Now I want to discuss everything that's in the middle, which will be more interesting experimentally. So, and there are actually many experiments on that, and people have seen reduced contrast. For example, Jörg Schmidtmeier and his condensates, and there is experiments in MIT. So this is just an example of such experiments where we have practically one-dimensional condensates.
What's the dislocation?
So this dislocation is one of the things that reduces the contrast. Every time this dislocation is basically, you can think about it as a phase. Every time you have a phase slip between the two condensates, it means that the phase goes by, say, pi half here, by pi, sorry. And if it changes by pi, it means that you have a dislocation in the fringes. So it's a phase slip by pi.
So is the geometry of those two pictures the same as what you were describing on the board? I mean,
yes, exactly.
I mean, you could have another geometry where. Where the light goes into the.
Oh yeah, where the light comes like that. So actually, sorry. So it's different experiments and there are different geometries. Sorry, in this experiment, the geometry is like I plotted in the board. And in this experiment, actually, the geometry is as you say. It's the light is coming from here, and in order to do the integration, you have to integrate yourself over the picture. Okay?
Well, it looks as if it's better not to do the integration because that way you get more information.
Well, yes, but it's true. But actually, it's you can see that it's well, you get in principle more information, but you have less statistics. So it turns out that it does make sense to do the integration, and in this case, and it will give you all the information basically that you have in these, at least in these simple systems. And this facelift, is one of the processes that can in principle reduce your contrast. Actually, I'm going to talk about facelifts in the first part, but. This is one of the things that can reduce it. So now we have this operator for the interference amplitude, which is exactly the same as before, a dagger 1, a 2. But now we have, because the light or in the picture, we integrate over this whole condensate or over some length scale that's the focal length of the beam or something like that, we have to integrate it over this z direction. Okay, so this gives us the operator that corresponds to the amplitude of the interference. And again, just as before, in order to find the actual amplitude of the interference we'll see, we'll have to take this operator squared and take the average of that, because taking just the average of this guy is zero, because we assume the condensates are independent. So when we do that, we have a four boson correlation function, but this four boson correlation function is actually decoupled very easily into two correlation functions within each of the condensates because they're decoupled from each other. And so if they're identical, we can just look at this correlation function and square it, and this is what we get. So basically, the fringe contrast now will depend on how the correlations decay within each condensate. And you know that if it's a one-dimensional condensate at zero temperature, the correlations decay like a power law with some power that depends on the interaction strength.
These
so,
are two 1D condensates.
Yeah, this is two independent 1D condensates. Basically, exactly the same experiment as we did before with single mode condensates. Now they're independent 1D condensates, and all the information we have to know is how the correlations decay, how these off-diagonal correlations decay within each condensate. If they decay like a power law, you integrate this thing, and you find that, so there is one L coming out from this, from integration over the center of mass coordinate, and you get that this thing goes like L to the power minus 2 minus 1 over K. So actually, if you remember, the amplitude of the interference pattern is square root of this thing. So let's look at how square root of this thing acts. When k is infinity, which corresponds to non-interacting bosons or perfect condensate, when it's a perfect condensate, it scales like L, as we anticipated before. When k is 1, or actually less than 1, we get square root here. Why do we get square root? It's very clear because if this goes like 1 over, if this goes faster than 1 over, decays faster than 1 over z, then it doesn't depend on the upper cutoff, so there is just this L in front times some constant. And this L in front, when you take a square root of that, you get that. So k equals 1 actually is a marginal case where you have some logarithmic correction.
Does this agree with the picture you had before of whether of the amplitude depending on whether you have coherence in the, because before you had a bunch of independent.
Oh yeah, yeah, independent.
It's related to that.
Yeah, it's related to that, but here I'm doing it, and I'm showing how exactly it depends on the correlations within the condensate. There were two limiting cases where it was very easy to analyze without really knowing about the correlation. But just
did
telling you what.
Many cases agree with.
Yeah. So for example, if you take here exponentially decaying correlations or delta function correlations, of course you'll have only the L here. And then you get square root, okay? But it turns out you don't need exponentially decaying correlations. It's enough that they decay faster than 1 over, decay faster than 1 over z to the power 1/2, because then when you square it, it decays faster than 1 over z, and then it doesn't depend on this upper cutoff, which is the length, and you get square root. So if they're short enough ranged, you will get square root.
And these A's are before time of flight. These are the original.
So these A's can be calculated using the original operator. All can be, you're right. Everything is, so the time of flight only comes into some, to this cosine, to this overall cosine of the interference.
The amplitude of that.
Right, and the amplitude of that just depends on the original operators before time of flight. That's a nice thing. So you can connect the amplitude of the interference pattern to operators before the time of flight.
And I'm confused about the arguments of those arguments. Can you go back two slides back, what you were trying to say?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so right. So what, there, they're the same z, what about x? They're the same x, or what?
X is, so it's exactly the same as before. So if we had, yeah, so x is here. X is one thing I didn't mention is that I assume that the condensates expand only in the x direction and not in the z. Okay, so I'm looking x is the distance from say the center between.
But the coordinates in those before time of flight operators in the x direction is just already taken into account by it's x minus d over 2 and x.
Right.
So they're just.
Right. This just has to do with the expansion, the ballistic expansion, right? The x
so
coordinate.
Just at a point, actually. You know, the original
right.
operators
right.
in the x, the delta function in the x.
What original operator is it? Oh, these A1. Yeah, A1, they're delta functions here. Well, they're not delta functions. Actually, you'll get, there are some say, Gaussian wave function, which will give you an overall envelope of how this thing is expanding. So it will be some expanding Gaussian.
The x is the variable you're observing on the
screen. Exactly. And z is the original.
But the original, the x, the labels where it comes to are just the labels 1 and 2. And
that's right. Exactly. Oh, okay. So it's okay. There is another assumption that it's long time of flight, so that I'm looking at x much larger than the original distance, the distance between the two condensates. So we are in the far field limit already. So all this I went on over that pretty fast. But
and then why? Okay, so here it's zz. While on the next transparency you were doing.
Because now I have to square this thing, right?
You're not doing correlation.
Yeah, right. So when you square it, you have two integrals over z. Right? That's, so you have no.
No, I understand. So can you go to the next? Oh, okay, and then you decouple. Okay.
Right, and I decouple because there are two decoupled condensates, I can decouple.
There's no A1, A2, thank you.
Right, so exactly. So this was about, we talked about the average interference pattern, average interference fringes. I just want to make one comment, I will not go through it. Thoroughly, but it's actually quite easy to show that if you have finite temperature, so first of all, if you have finite temperature in 1D condensate, you know that it's going to be exponentially decaying. So, but now you have two regimes. One regime is when the correlation length is much larger than the size of the system, and then essentially it will be the same as a zero temperature condensate. Or you have the regime where the correlation length is much smaller than the size of the system. And in this case, you know that it's going to be exponentially decaying correlation, so as a function of L, it's going to be always trivial square root. But it turns out that this non-trivial decay of correlations come in to the temperature dependence in this case. So the temperature dependence will be universal and depend only on how correlations decay within each correlation length. Because within each correlation length, you still have this power law decay.
But uniform in
yeah. So we assume that they're uniform, just finite size. So in this, and you'll have to do some kind of LDA or more.
You don't have to do LDA. It has been calculated rigorously.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a harmonic confinement, then the exponential, very well known developer from a long time ago, is valid only if the correlation length is much smaller than the characteristic size of the system. Say 100 or something. If not, then this dependence changes to sort of power law. Yes.
If
the phase coherence length, or you call it correlation length,
yes,
is much smaller than the characteristic size of the harmonically trapped system,
yeah,
then the usual exponential formula works, and there is nothing.
Exponential decay. Yeah.
Yes. Exponential
decay. Yeah, and then this will give you that.
But this requires that the phase coherence length is much smaller than the size of the system.
That's what I said. If it's much larger than the size of the system, you'll get a power law.
Just a second. If it's not much larger, let's factor 100 than the size of it. If it's around 20, 10, then the exponential dependence changes to power law because of the role of low energy excitation. It has been done a long time ago. Okay, but please continue.
Yeah, I know. Of course. I mean, that's what I think it's the same as what I said, that if the correlation length is much larger, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, if the correlation length is much larger than the size of the system, it will be a power law. Am I right or wrong?
I'm saying something else. I'm saying that the usual exponential dependence for the correlation, for the one-body density matrix.
At finite t.
It only works if and only if the phase coherence length is much smaller than the characteristic size of a harmonically trapped system. If it's only factor 10 or 20 or 5, it doesn't work.
I see. Okay, interesting. Okay. That's I understand. Okay. So you're probably
the only thing I said. That's, of course, if it's much smaller, it works.
Yes. So I don't capture well the intermediate behavior between very much. So this captures well when the correlation length is much larger than the size of the system, or when it's much smaller. And I think you'll have to use your theory in order to understand what will happen in the intermediate regime. So, Okay, so now I talked only about the average of the interference pattern, and this is something, because I want to go to dephasing, I'll go over more quickly, but you can imagine that if there is, you know, these phase fluctuations, they reduce the average contrast, but as I showed you in one extreme example, it's clear that they will also make the fluctuations, even in the thermodynamic limit, when you have many many particles, the fluctuations will also be non-zero. So you'll also have a fluctuation of the fringe contrast. Every time you do the experiment, you'll find a different fringe contrast, and we want to characterize this distribution, because this A is a quantum operator and has some distribution.
Just wanted to ask, so when you calculate this delta rho,
yeah,
there's also this term that comes from the Kami theorem. What, that's thrown out?
Yeah, so all these so the meaning of the term that come, it all comes into the short noise, into things that are sub.
If you were to keep it, it would give you
sub n correction. Sub n. Yeah, you can think about it the following way, right? Because every time you do a commutation, you lose a power of n because you have so you get subleading corrections from that, which are important if you're interested in, you know, the things like the difference between a coherent state and Fock state or these kinds of things. But it doesn't. So we're going to see that there is actually a fluctuation. A correction that is in the leading order. It doesn't scale like shot noise. There is a fluctuation correction in this case that is in the leading order, so we're going to forget about commutations. So we want to calculate higher moments of this fringe contrast. And in principle, well, you have to you square it many times, and then you have integral over many not only z and z prime, but we have integral over z1 to zn, z1 prime to z prime n, exactly the same as before. And now we can, in principle, because these are in are independent, we can, well, I already did this here. I only considered correlations within one condensate. And actually, these integrals look very, very similar to expressions well known from one-dimensional Coulomb gas. So let me, only the integrals here are over some spatial coordinate, and usually people do it in, say, in impurity, quantum impurity problems, these integrals over time direction. So let me show you, well, what I did here actually is made some nasty trick that I took this to be periodic boundary conditions, which is probably not completely okay, and then scaled everything by L, and what we get, these integrals up to a factor that corresponds to the, just the squared fringe amplitude, has to do with these nasty looking integrals, that all of them come from, for a very...
Can I just ask something? Yeah. So I guess a while back people worked on, in 3D people worked on this condensate fluctuation, so meaning the fluctuations in the occupancy of the K equals
of the,
zero.
Of the,
the occupancy of the,
oh, yeah,
the K equals zero state.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of that was in 3D, and the non-trivial thing is that the fluctuations aren't just one every thing. Because of the Goldstein mode.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, I can think of these moments as just moments of the condensate.
These moments?
Condensate.
Well, there is no condensate fraction here.
No, but I mean, if I take A to be classical, then I've got an integral over, well, A over Z1. A Z1 over Z1, that is, in fact, the Q equals zero component of the condensate wave functions.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you can think about this. Yeah. So it's, you can think that if in a finite size system, it's as if you have some moment, some condensate, because it's a finite size system, we're integrating over L, and this is the moments of, yeah, I think it's the same. And I want to make just a small analogy that might help some people here, but some people not, maybe will not help it. But actually, the same integrals, and for a very clear reason, come from this problem. So you have a Luttinger liquid and an impurity in the middle of the Luttinger liquid, and you want to calculate the partition function of this system. So actually, okay, this would be trivial. It's not trivial just because of this term, which is the tunneling across this impurity. And
it's just like Coulomb gas. Right?
Yeah, and this is a Coulomb gas. You get the Coulomb gas partition function by taking this in powers of g. So if you take this in powers of g, it looks like the grand canonical partition function for a Coulomb gas, where this z2n is the canonical partition function of the Coulomb gas. And because you get powers of this thing, you have many, many correlation functions. You have these correlation functions over an integral over one, d tau 1 to d tau n, and d tau 1 prime, d tau n prime, which is called here 2n. So you have all exactly the same kind of integrals, only over time and not over space. But you see that this Luttinger liquid action, time and space come in exactly the same way. So basically, you're going to get exactly the same result, whether you do it over time or over space. And so the problem maps to exactly calculating this partition function for this moment by moment, basically calculating these partition functions moment by moment. But in principle, if you could calculate the whole partition function, you'll have the generating function for the full distribution, in principle.
So just to go ahead, this is, yeah, perfectly true. At finite temperature, it only...
Yes, that's right. Right. Yes. Yeah. Well, actually, this is in finite temperature. Wait a minute. Because in the tau direction, you have some... you have some finite length in the time direction.
So it's length.
Right. The finite length is the finite
condensate at zero temperature.
Right, exactly. The condensate at zero temperature maps to this partition function at finite temperature. Mm-hmm. And the length has to do with the...
It's a circular condensate length.
What?
It's a circular condensate.
What's a circular? Yeah, yeah. So what I said before is I actually, yeah, I did this periodic boundary conditions. It turns out now actually a student of Eugene has done that for open boundary conditions. It turns out that at least qualitatively the results are the same, but the limiting distribution is slightly different. And it's nicer here, but well.
But I mean, this is all just a calculated integral. Does it agree if you go back to the case that you already did for N equal 1?
What's n equal 1?
Well, this is just to calculate that integral.
Yeah, but it's all the integrals.
We already did this integral for n equal 1, and does it give
this? Yeah, of course. Yeah,
you did this approach.
Oh, no, it's practically the same, because it's just scaling, because it's all the difference is sine instead of 1 over x minus x prime, right? So you have sine of x minus x prime. If it's long enough, it will be the same scaling, okay? But so everything is very similar, but okay, now there is some magic that happens that I'm you can show first of all that this Z impurity is so we want this distribution of fringe amplitudes. I'll not get into that because there is some magic here that postdoc Vladimir Gritsev found that this partition function can in principle be calculated exactly. And I just want to show you that this partition function is a generating function for the distribution, and it's clear from what I wrote before, only one has to do instead, it's not exactly a generating function in a usual sense, because the powers of n these powers are not the usual powers, and that's why you don't have to do you're not doing a Fourier transform to get this distribution, but a Bessel transform. So in that sense, it's different, but you can show that it's the same as doing the Bessel transform to the, so when you do the inverse Bessel transform, you get somehow the impurity partition function with an imaginary coupling, an imaginary impurity coupling. So it seems kind of like a strange problem, but then it turns out that by some magic, one can compute this guy exactly. And this magic has to do with something in conformal field theory that I must admit I don't understand so well. But it boils down to, okay, so the guys who found this thing are these guys. They're mathematical physicists. And they found that basically to calculate this guy, you have to solve a one-dimensional.
Can you
justify what
the two arguments of the
Z impurity? Oh, K is the Lattinger parameter, which is exactly the same as the Lattinger parameter in our case, and G is the fugacity, and IG is just the imaginary.
G is the coefficient from the cosine.
Right, right. It turns out by something that I read several times and I don't fully understand, so I'm not going to explain for us, it's going to be some magic. It turns out that if you take the spectral determinant of this of this Schrödinger equation, and this Schrödinger equation is a single particle Schrödinger equation, you compute its spectral determinant, which is defined by this product. So it boils down to solving a single particle problem, and you get from the spectral determinant of this thing equals exactly this partition function in full. So yeah.
What's the connection?
So,
it
depends on E, and these are the eigenvalues. So, if you have all the eigenvalues of this,
and how do I get Z impurity?
Well, it's a complicated function, but it, you can, I mean, instead of E, you put in this thing. Okay, so that's.
Oh, that's D. That's an argument.
Yeah. That's the argument of D is a function. Okay, so I'm not going to get how you get this. It's complicated.
Do you use the exact solution to that Sine-Gordon model or something?
No, it's, you don't have to do it.
But it must be a simple limit where you take, if you take...
No, there is no sign,
If you take large K, then you can take the harmonic approximation of that Sine-Gordon model, calculate a bosonic determinant.
Right, so in...
That must be a bosonic determinant.
You're probably right, I mean...
You can calculate the large K.
Yeah, I think you're right, that you can make this harmonic approximation to the Sine-Gordon model and get everything. And in this case, yes, you're probably, I mean, it's a boundary Sine-Gordon model, but you can, you can, I think in the harmonic approximation, you can get it, and you can get the limiting distributions exactly. And actually, in a follow-up paper, we basically did something very similar to that.
Is it now independent of what k is, bigger one, less than one?
Well, actually, for k less than one, I don't. No, k less than one, it's still valid, but you get. Well, for k less than one, we know that we always get a Poissonian distribution because it's all short-range correlations, and it comes into all the so. And this is how the distribution looks, and well, actually, this is an old transparency, but in principle, there is a limiting distribution at large k, which can be shown to be Gumbel distribution at large k. It can be proved to be Gumbel distribution, and basically, you can prove it by this, by doing this harmonic approximation, and also we can fit this exact result to the Gumbel distribution, and the Gumbel distribution is a distribution of, you know, if you want to find the best performing stocks over a period of such and such years, these things distribute usually as it's a distribution of catastrophes or extreme values, and the point is, I think it makes sense here because basically the contrast is usually perfect, but what is most effective in reducing the contrast are very rare and extreme fluctuations of the phase. So in some sense it makes sense that it would go to this. And just for a little bit experimental results, so you can do the same in 2D. I mean, all of what I said was in 1D, but it works just exactly the same in 2D. But in 2D, actually the light integrates for you in one dimension, and then you have to integrate in the remaining direction, okay? So you have some, so you usually do not change the length in this direction where the light integrates for you, only change the length in the direction that, yeah. Any questions? So this is the. So this is the geometry. This is the paper by. I'm just reviewing now the paper by Dalibard, who did this experiment with two pancakes, and they're expanding in this direction. And now there is a light coming in from this direction. So the whole density distribution looks kind of like that. It has these oscillating stripes, and this light just integrates through it, and you get this. These fringes. So in one dimension, it integrates automatically by the light, and one other dimension is what you see here, and you can integrate various distances on this dimension up to various, and these are the plots you see. And this is low temperature, you see that the fringes are very straight, and high temperature, you see that the fringes are oscillating. And these oscillations, when you integrate, will reduce the contrast. This is exactly what will reduce the contrast. So they did that. So you see they're integrating over a larger and larger scale and getting some contrast as a function of integration distance. And plotting this on a logarithmic scale, I think. And in the end, they basically fit to our formula, which is this correlation length squared. Just they divide by this Lx. It's just a convention, and you get 1 over Lx to a power some 2 alpha. And you know that in above the Coster-Litz-Taulis transition, you have exponentially decaying correlations, and then this alpha is 1 half. This is basically another manifestation of the fact that if you have short-range correlations, you have diffusion. And below the Coster-Litz-Taulis transition, I mean, you know you have some maximal decay power for the decay below which the system disorders, so we expect that this alpha has to be below 1/4. And indeed, when they measure this exponent as a function of the temperature, they see 1/2 at so at very low temperature they see something coming up, and then jump to 1/2 from 1/4. So you have 1/4 and then jump to 1/2. But it's not a jump, of course, it's a crossover, it's a finite system. So all of this finite system behavior, complicated and maybe interesting finite size effect, should be taken into account. And they're even maybe even simpler in the critical regime. So I mean, all these finite size effects have not been treated, and maybe should be treated much better. So actually, just to mention that at the same point where alpha departs from one quarter, you see, you start to see dislocations in the fringes, which means that you have vortices. So basically, you see also the appearance of vortices at the same time where the power law changes. So,
so can you ask another question, again, using the, looking at this Coulomb-Gauss expansion, could you interpret it as the distribution of vortices in the high temperature phase, but where the coefficients are not moments, but they're actually the probabilities of having n vortices, and therefore you reproduce something like the same, the statistics of the number of vortices.
Oh. Well, but here it's not statistics yet, right? Oh, but yeah. So can you think about it? Well, but this is two dimensions and not one dimension.
Okay, all right. So yeah. Go to the real sine log, not boundary sine log. Look at the Coulomb-Gauss expansion there and interpret the probability
of the probability to have all vortices. Yeah, but there the this. Yeah, well, this is just how, but remember that this impurity point in this effective Sine-Gordon model is completely fictitious. It's not, there is no real impurity. It just tells me,
yeah. It discounts the number of,
right.
It's just the partition function of the Coulomb-Gauss.
Yeah.
And you can interpret the coefficients as like the probability of finding n
That's true. So in the Coulomb-Gauss, that is true, but I don't think it's true in the case for the actual condensate I'm observing, because I'm observing a condensate at zero temperature which actually has no vortices.
You're not talking about that's the counting problem about 2D finite temperature.
So 2D finite temperature.
And yeah. Count the vortices. Look at the vortex.
Oh, okay. And you say maybe counting the vortex distribution will give you something about the statistics of the. Well, of course, you will have only vortex anti-vortex pairs below. Above the transition. Above the transition, or look at the dual picture below the transition.
Right.
Below the transition.
What you're doing is below the transition.
Yeah.
The statistics are
common. Yeah. Oh, above the transition, you say, oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. I see. But how would you see that in the interference, really?
Well, I guess.
Oh, you'd see that in the just by counting vortices, basically. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, so there might be some there has to be some duality between this statistics and the statistics of phase below.
The coefficients in the Coulomb-Gauss are not moments, but actual probabilities. So
I see.
It's a duality between those ones.
I see. Okay. I have to think about it. Okay. That could be. I have to. Okay. So I want to move on to the next topic. What time is it? So do I have some time? So I want to talk about defacing. I promised I'll talk about dephasing, about dynamics. So we had a paper recently about that on CondMat, and there was a follow-up paper by Anton Burkov and Eugene Demler and Misha Lukin. And now we're discussing how in these 1D and 2D condensates, if you start from a perfectly defined phase, how this phase will disappear after a while.
Do you obtain the Ehrenfest time at which this phase became, or not?
The Ehrenfest time. I know what is the Ehrenfest time, but I did not
Here in this problem, people may call it in this way, and people in nonlinear physics, Zaslavsky and Hill, and his collaborators, they did it in 1982. You get exponent and the power of minus t squared.
For two-dimensional and one-dimensional condensates?
Just for a simple model, for a coherent state.
Ah, okay. For a coherent state, I think that it's a very simple problem for a coherent state. I'll go over the coherent state. Maybe it's not. Okay, so let's see what we get for a coherent state just as a practice, okay? So. Okay, before we go to this practice problem, I want to tell you what is actually done in the experiment. So first you have a single condensate, and then you split it into two coherently. You wait for some time, and then measure the phases. So now they're not independent. They originally in a state where the phase is fairly well defined, and then they measure the interference pattern and look at the phase distribution. I'll make it more clear. But
why are there stripes now on the interference pattern? I mean, no. Is this time or?
No. This is not time. This is the interference pattern you see. Just the interference pattern.
One-dimensional condensates, right?
Yeah, one-dimensional condensates. They blow up like that. Yeah, they propagate in radially from the wires, and then this is the phase. This is what you see. But this moves every experiment. If you wait some time, you'll get a distribution of this. I'll show. But I want to set the basic problem for a second. So you have a one-dimensional condensate, and there is of course no Lagrange order in the phase because of Merriman-Wagner's theorem in 1D and at zero temperature and 2D at finite temperature, there is not going to be any long-range order in the phase. But when you split the condensate in two, you basically impose long-range order in the relative phase. Okay, so the relative phase is now very long, very ordered. It's everywhere the same. And the question, and you know that this is not going to be the ground state of this is not the equilibrium state of the condensates because they really don't want to have a long range order in the relative phase. And this is going to be disordered. This is what I'm going to show you. And the question is, how is it done?
And
they're not interacting with each other, but they're interacting within each condensate, and that's enough, I'll show you, okay? I'll show you, because actually you can show that you can split to relative and symmetric and anti-symmetric degrees of freedom, and only the anti-symmetric degrees of freedom actually you're measuring, okay? But even the Hamiltonian within the anti-symmetric degrees of freedom, and even if you're taking a harmonic approximation, it's basically also like a Lattinger liquid. It's also hydrodynamic theory for a condensate, and it doesn't want to support long range order. But
you're focusing on the relative phase.
Yeah, but I'll do that. But in just one minute, if you allow me. So these are experiments where this was measured in one-dimensional condensates. So this is after a short time of expansion, and you see the phase distribution here. So this is phase and amplitude. You see the amplitude has some amplitude, but the phase is very well defined after a short time. After a much. So I'm actually, Joa, if you have to go, then you can go, or if you stay, then I'm just having trouble talking like that.
Oh,
so.
The thing is that I was just going to apologize because at 11:15 I have an appointment. I was not aware that the seminar was so long.
Yeah, that's how it.
Yeah, it's a while they're talking. So, which phase is it? This is a relative phase. What are you measuring?
So I'm measuring
phase of the interference.
This is the relative phase. This is the phase of the interference pattern. Because they see an interference pattern, they can measure the phase. So from 0 to 2 pi.
So you're seeing wiggling.
Yeah, you see wiggles, and you see if the wiggles they have a very well-defined.
Is it from shot to shot?
Yeah, from shot to shot. There are many shots here, so these X's are different shots. Okay, and they put it on an amplitude and phase map. Okay, so you put many phases, so you see that this is, and now you can plot a histogram of the phase. And now you can plot a histogram of the phase after a longer time. And you can wait longer and longer and plot this histogram of the phase.
When you say phase, you mean the...
Yeah, the phase of the interference pattern. Right, the position, the position of the interference pattern.
You can measure it from 0 to 2 pi.
Yes. Well...
Because you can't measure it. You can only measure it from 0 to 2 pi. I mean, we don't know.
Well, if you start from very sharp distribution, you know that if it goes that way, you put it minus. So it's from minus to minus pi this way and minus pi this way, right? On a circle, you can always put it, right?
But everything you were telling us in the first part, there was no relative phase at all. The relative phase was like...
Yes, so that's...
So there was only information in the second order coherence, but not in the first order.
Right. Now it's going to be different. I'm going to set up the problem, but now it's going to be different,
but
because now the phase...
To delta rho average, right?
Yes, I'm going to write it. So I'm going to write the operator I'm measuring. But I first want to show the experiments. So the experiments do measure a well-defined relative phase, and it goes away with time. And here is how it goes away with time. delta, this width of the distribution they plot. And, well, I showed you. And the observable, actually, you can think of is just e to the I phi, where phi is the phase. When you know, you see that when the phase is well defined, this A equals 1. After some time, there is partial coherence. It's less than 1. And it can dephase completely. And then it's going to be 0, right? So, okay, now I'll talk about this problem that Joras says is very, very complicated. And it might be, the subtleties might be very complicated, but I claim that the actual problem is very simple. So the essence of it is very simple and was captured by Leggett very clearly, I think. Yeah.
Can I just interrupt a bit? What's confusing me is as that relative phase coherence is disappearing, so you're saying there's still now, suppose it completely gone away.
There is still an amplitude.
No, there's still, right, there's still an amplitude?
Yes. Because it basically goes to
the second order coherence coming in, and
I'm measuring something that doesn't
care about the second order.
Yeah, I'm measuring just rho now. Okay, so e to the I phi, that just rho interference. So I'm measuring just this now. I want to know how this goes away. Okay, so I'm measuring something that goes to zero when phases.
Because you do many experiments compared to the many shots compared to the previous.
Yes,
one.
Yes. So I can measure in many shots. I can, because if I do one shot, I see some phase, but I don't know if this is the phase I'll always get or okay. The phase. So now I'm doing many shots and seeing how this phase changes from shot to shot. Exactly. These are the many shots I'm doing.
Okay? Otherwise, if you're doing single shot, then it would be.
Then I don't know.
Distribution for d rho, right?
Right. So I don't actually, I have no idea if the phase is well defined or not from a single shot. That was, yeah, that's the point. Now what is phase diffusion? And people asked about, talked about in the context of just simple coherent states or simple condensates. And it's very simple. So you think about splitting two condensates as just a Josephson junction. That at some point you cut off the connection between the two condensates in the Josephson junction. Okay, so you split, you cut the connection, and now the only term is the interaction. Okay, u n squared. Of course, there is some. So this is the simplest thing when you have just interaction of the just a single mode in each condensate. So after the split, your original, after you split the condensate, you have a wave function for this phase. That's a phase and number representation for the Josephson junction. Phase and number are non-commuting variables. They're basically like x and p. And you can write down a wave function in the phase representation. And initially, after you split, this wave function is a very, very sharp Gaussian. And you can even know what is the width of this Gaussian, because when you split, if you split it in such a way that every particle basically moves from the superposition to the symmetric superposition between the two wells, you know that the particle number uncertainty is going to be square root of n of the total number. So the width of the Gaussian is going to be 1 over square root of the total number. At least it's going to scale that way. So this is going to be the width of the Gaussian. And now it's very clear what will happen, because now the Hamiltonian is just a free Hamiltonian. Just a free Hamiltonian for n. At least the initial distribution doesn't care about the fact that the phase is a compact variable. In order to take care of this, of course, you need more care. But at least the initially it doesn't know. And it's just a Gaussian that's evolving under this free Hamiltonian. And of course, we know, because of the ballistic this ballistic propagator, this thing is going to remain Gaussian, and it's going to grow like t squared over some tau squared. And it's easy to show that this tau squared is just proportional to square root of the particle number over the chemical potential of the system, which is u times n. So this is a very simple thing. It's called phase diffusion, and experimentalists have seen it very many times. So Okay, I have to ask Jorah why he thinks it's very complicated, but it's I think it's not such a complicated effect. And actually, the effects I'm going to talk about are not so complicated either, in my opinion. It's only now that I have many modes in my condensate and not a single mode, and they're all coupled to each other.
So how you mentioned Erentz time, which appears in the chaotic dynamics. Here the dynamics are not chaotic. I have no idea what he's saying.
Yeah, so I don't know, and maybe you have to consider it. And when you look at more, I have to ask him. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know, but at least experiments are very consistent with this picture. There are many experiments in MIT and there are other places for interferometry, and they were very important. At least. On the bulk, it doesn't seem like, maybe there are many subtle effects that have to be considered, but okay.
So making some single mode approximation, or at least in the previous.
Yeah, now I'm not making a single, now I'm going to look at the Hamiltonian, which for two uncoupled condensates, which are initially in some well-defined phase, which I'll show the wave function in a second, but I'm going to make the harmonic approximation. I'm going to take the quantum hydrodynamic theory for the condensates. Whether that is correct to do or not, I'm going to check in the end, okay? So there is going to be a self-consistency check of whether I'm allowed to do this hydrodynamic approximation also for the dynamics. For the statics, we know, for equilibrium, we know that all terms beyond this are non-relevant if you're in the superfluid phase. But in the dynamics, it might be more subtle and they might appear, might be important. But let's make this first. And you can think of that as phases defined over a coarse-grained grain that is of order the healing length of the condensate. This is the cutoff of the hydrodynamic theory, the short length scale cutoff. So this is harmonic. And you can define symmetric and anti-symmetric fields and write the same Hamiltonian just for the symmetric and anti-symmetric fields, and it'll stay the same and they're decoupled because it's quadratic. Okay, and we're interested only in the relative phase, so we can forget about the symmetric Hamiltonian and only worry about the dynamics of the anti-symmetric Hamiltonian. And the initial state we prepare, okay, so in the symmetric phase, actually the initial state we prepare might be complicated because it's the basically the state that was originally of the original bosons. But now we split and take all the bosons into the symmetric superposition or some other state that depends on how fast we split, but this will only be a function of the anti-symmetric coordinates. This is just the same Hamiltonian written in k-space, where you explicitly see that it's just, you know, decoupled harmonic oscillators. That's why it's going to be a simple problem. So this is the wave function separated into the symmetric and the anti-symmetric and symmetric components. I'm for now just going to consider the simplest thing that I'm doing it fast. Actually, if I'm doing the split fast, and that can be shown rigorously, that if the split is fast compared to the chemical potential inside each Hamiltonian, but slow compared to the transverse level spacings in the trap, then basically each particle goes to the symmetric superposition of the particle in the well one and well two, but doesn't change its longitudinal position and state. So
is it then obvious how to do the how to convert that into a statement about the hydrodynamic modes?
Yeah, so I'm going to write this so it's a statement. It's going to be a statement about what's my initial wave function in terms of the hydrodynamic modes. And it's in terms of the hydrodynamic modes, it's like my previous thing that I split two condensates without doing any squeezing, what experimentalists say usually say. So I'm basically writing a wave function of the phase, but now the phase is a phase field. It's a Gaussian, but it's integral over R. At every point in space, it's going to be a Gaussian of the same width. And this width is going to be determined just by the particle number uncertainty that I induced by doing this split, which is square root of n in each coarse-grained part of my lattice. So that's why I'll get this rho here, exactly like in the case of these two condensates. So basically, it comes into the hydrodynamics just as this initial state for the hydrodynamics. Okay? So this initial state for the hydrodynamic is a Gaussian of the same width in every point in space. There is no correlation. I'm not inducing any correlations in space by doing this split, any special correlations. So it's just going to be the same width every point in space. So it means it's the same width every point in Q space. And it's going to be set by the density, basically.
It's not obvious. It's not obvious to me. Why is it all just point by point like this? Why is there no...
I mean, there is no time for... I mean, if you do it fast compared to all time scales within a single condensate, there is no time to transmit anything. I mean, it's just going to be all local. The spacing between transverse levels here are much larger than, you know, the largest energy scales that have to do with a single condensate, like the chemical potential. Okay, so that's why it's one-dimensional.
You arrange the experimental conditions such that you can put it into this.
Right. But actually you can go beyond that, and I'm not going. You can go beyond that, and actually some there was a nice calculation by Anton Burkov and Eugene Demmler went beyond that, and basically you can show that their calculation basically maps back to ours when this limit when chemical potential of each condensate is much smaller than the rate at which you. At which you split the condensates. So now we have an initial wave function, and we have a harmonic Hamiltonian under which it propagates. So in principle, we know everything. We can solve the problem exactly. So we can write down the wave function at time t, any time t. So this is the wave function in the phase representation at any time t. So for every Q, it's a Gaussian that develops under a chemical under a harmonic oscillator with a frequency associated with that Q. So you know that the Gaussian wave function remains Gaussian; it just breathes in the harmonic in a harmonic potential, and that's what it does. So this sigma of Q, which is the size of the Gaussian, is breathing. So this is the size of the Gaussian. And it has exactly this form, right? So our operator A is just a sum over these breathing widths of Gaussians. And it looks like a complicated integral, but actually it's very simple. You can easily see that this integral, it just doesn't depend on time, just gives you some constant. And this integral is actually easy to do. You can change variables here and get just this. And you can do this in any dimension now. This integral, there is a dz here that I forgot. You can do this integral in any dimension. And you can easily see that in three dimensions, in three dimensions, that gives you a constant as a function of time, which means that in three dimensions, in an infinite system, I'm going to touch on a finite system in a second, but in an infinite system in three dimensions, you have no dephasing. And that makes sense, actually, because you put your system in a well-defined phase state. You impose long-range order, but you know that the system in three dimensions actually likes long-range order. So there is no reason why long-range order will be destroyed. In one dimension, actually, the system really doesn't like long-range order at zero temperature. So it will go away, and it goes away exponentially. So you see that this integral is linear in time. You put it here, linear in time means exponential decay of the correlations with time. Also makes sense. One-dimensional systems don't like long-range order. Two-dimension is actually a very interesting and limiting case, because we're at zero temperature. At zero temperature, 2D systems in principle can support long-range order. But the wave function we put it in is actually different than the wave function that would support the long-range order in that it's not the ground state. So we pump some energy into the system, and this energy goes to disorder the phase. But it disorders the phase in... So you see that this is logarithmic here, which if you plug here means that you get a power law dephasing. And this power law is just due to the fact that you're basically in this marginal region, this marginal dimension, two dimensions is marginal here. So
the initial noise acts just like an effective temperature for those, because those are just sort of ground in motion, but with an effective temperature given by both in the mirrors.
Yeah, by the initial, I mean, the initial distribution is, so there's two things that sets how fast this will, so let me write the, yeah, so maybe, there are two things actually that set the time for the dephasing. So one thing is the interactions within the condensate, which comes into this K. If the interaction is zero, basically taking k to infinity, there is not going to be any dephasing. Second thing is basically the initial distribution. So this is why rho comes in here. Because if the initial distribution is very, very narrow in the phase, extremely narrow, too narrow in the phase, it means that it has a lot of large momentum components that can, you know, phi dot components. There is a lot of uncertainty in phi dot that will dephase it very, very quickly. So that's why the density also comes in. So it's k squared and the density that come in to the dephasing time. And it comes into the exponent in the 2D. You have to just note that in 1D, this k is dimensionless. And since I use the same notation, you have to understand that k in two dimensions is not dimensionless. It has units of 1 over length. Okay, so this is 1D and 2D, which are the two interesting dimensions.
How A over T, this is the one by the density matrix of over.
Oh, no, okay, so, yeah, so you missed that when you were. Sure. No, it's important. Yeah, so A is not the one by the density matrix at all. A is the local E to its. Basically local at point x, a dagger 1, a 2, x, which you can write as also in the hydrodynamic description, e to the I, phi 1 minus phi 2. At the same point, as a function of time, okay? As a function of time. That's what I'm calculating. So this is the operator that gives me the amplitude. But now, not amplitude squared, but actual amplitude of the interference pattern, averaged over many shots. Whether it will be of definite phase or non-definite phase. So, and this is what I so for one dimension we get again. I stress it, one dimension it decays exponentially. Two dimensional dimensions it scales like a power law. But all this was for an infinite system, and you remember that in these zero-dimensional systems, we had this phase diffusion, which was Gaussian phase diffusion. How does this tie into that? So actually, if the systems are really finite, you have to be careful. I did an integral, and I didn't take into account the Q equals zero mode. The Q equals zero mode is very special because it's not a harmonic oscillator. There is no restoring force for the Q equals zero mode, if you remember. So I'll show you again the. Right, so it's not all zero. There is still an interaction in the Q equals zero mode, but there is no, the frequency is zero, but there is an interaction. So if I want to consider a finite size system, I have to be careful and treat the Q equal to zero mode differently. If someone knows about Anderson Tower and how you prove that there is finite compressibility to a system with only Goldstone modes, that actually comes from this Q equal to zero mode and.
What did you call it? Anderson?
I think it's called, I think the first person who treated this Q equal to zero mode, but maybe I'm wrong about, was Anderson back in the 60s to understand why a system with Goldstone modes has a finite, with a linearly dispersing Goldstone mode and broken phase symmetry has a finite compressibility. Actually, it also works for, for anti-ferromagnetic systems. And the point is that the compressibility actually comes from this Q equal to zero mode that you can.
I don't understand. If you have a linear spectrum, then you just compute density correlation function and it gives you a finite value. Why is it so complicated? Why is it coming from Q equal zero?
So.
Density is gradient of the phase, so
it's
Q square in the numerator, and then the propagator is 1 over Q square.
There is some problem for because if you have it's true if you take only the Goldstone modes but you forget about okay, so I'm not sure. Let's discuss it after. But actually, if you break phase symmetry, then you have square root of n fluctuation in the particle number, which would imply that you have seem to imply that you must have infinite compressibility. But okay, but let's.
Maybe there's a problem I don't see.
Okay, Maybe okay. So maybe I'm. Anyways, it's not. It was just a comment. It has nothing to do with this. But you understand that here you have to treat the Q equal to zero mode differently because it's not. It's basically a mode that has no restoring force in the harmonic potential. So basically, just this mode looks like this. It's an interaction term. There is an interaction n squared, but there is no restoring force. So it actually acts like phase diffusion. And it gives you exactly the same. So you can write this down using our parameters, and it goes like this. And you can convert this to chemical potential and number of particles, and it gives you exactly the phase diffusion that I gave before for a single mode problem with exactly the same dependence, square root of total particle number over chemical potential. So. So this was all at finite temperature, and last thing I want to discuss is finite temperature. That was all zero temperature. Last thing I want to discuss is zero temperature, is finite temperature. And so remember, we had a wave function for the average and the relative phase, the symmetric and the relative phase. And they were just a cross product, but now we have to change this. The symmetric phase has to be changed to some density matrix at finite temperature, which reflects the original temperature of the condensate. But this relative phase part actually doesn't change because it just has to do with the dynamics of the splitting and energy levels of the. So it just independent of temperature. So if we keep this hydrodynamic approximation, temperature just doesn't come in because we just have to evolve this guy. But of course, this is not going to be true because there are really unharmonic terms which couple us to the symmetric degrees of freedom. And taking this into account in this highly non-equilibrium problem is very difficult. And the way we did that is numerically. So actually, I'm not going to describe the numerics. The numerics are done on Hubbard model, and we're doing it in a semi-classical method called truncated Wigner approximation, which is actually, at least the essence of that of it is very nice and simple. And I can tell you, the idea is that the leading semi-classical corrections to Gross-Pitayevsky, leading quantum corrections to Gross-Pitayevsky equations, comes from the fact that in Gross-Pitayevsky we are treating psi as a number, not as an operator. The leading corrections to this comes from the fact that psi has a distribution in the initial state, which is a quantum distribution. So the initial state is a quantum state, and so there is an uncertainty between psi and psi star, which we don't have in actual Gross-Pitayevsky equation. So what we do is basically take just the take just classical paths using Gross-Pitayevsky equations, but starting from some initial distribution of psi stars, which reflect the original density matrix, right, written in terms of psi and psi stars.
So it's a classical distribution.
It's not a classical distribution. In principle, it can get it can have negative values. So it's not strictly speaking. But you can show that for very for these cases, actually, it looks like a classical distribution.
It's only the initial state you put that in, right?
Yeah, the initial state is a quantum ensemble of initial conditions, and then you propagate these initial conditions using Gross-Pitayevsky equation. This method is called truncated Wigner approximation for some historical reasons. Well, there is some reason, but
somehow this is in the initial condition. That's the most important contribution.
You can show rigorously that this is the first order correction in H bar. It comes into the initial conditions. It's basically very. It's actually very similar to Keldysh. Only here you propagate an operator and the density matrix. You do not propagate the density matrix. I think in Keldysh usually, but people who know better Keldysh can tell me. But I think that it's very similar to Keldysh. You can show that the first leading order corrections comes from, again, you have quantum and classical fields. In the leading order, the quantum fields enter only in the initial conditions to give you some density matrix, that some distribution, which is a Wigner distribution of initial conditions. And the classical fields give you the dynamics. And then in the next orders, you have to include the quantum fields also in the dynamics. So which is very much more complicated. So and actually for a harmonic oscillator, this the truncated Wigner approximation would be exact, as usually in you have exact semi-classical approximation is exact for a harmonic oscillator. So this is what we get for the decay of the coherence as a function of time. So for very low t, it matches very well with the expression we got analytically from the hydrodynamic theory. For high t, actually, yeah, for high t, it starts to deviate. And if we plot just the dephasing time as a function of t, you see that there is a very flat region at, okay, we plot it here as a function of 1 over t, if you want. This is 1 over t. Forget about this. And this is tau over tau from the hydrodynamic theory. And you see that the hydrodynamic theory is correct for low temperatures, but there is some crossover temperature where it goes to quantum, to classical dephasing, where temperature becomes important. And this temperature scale is actually very, it's very nice. You can convert this temperature scale T star and find that, actually this is for different realizations and it's all scaled on the same, if we scale it that way, they're all on top of each other, and the crossover scale T star is when temperature is of the order of the chemical potential. When temperature is of the order of the chemical potential, then of course it becomes the most important effect, much more than the energy you pump into the system. Before that, basically the most important effect is the dynamics, because the energy you pump into the system is much larger than the temperature. The energy you pump into the system by splitting it in a non-adiabatic way is more important than the temperature. And that's why it's really temperature independent and the hydrodynamic result is correct, or seems to be correct.
And this is without this t squared exponent to the power minus t divided by t squared.
Oh yeah, actually this is for a finite system where we actually included the finite size correction also. So we also included finite size corrections here. To the, if I'm not mistaken, in this graph it's included also.
So the term that you showed on one of the previous sheets, exponent in the power minus t squared divided by t squared, is included here?
Yes. Okay, so in this, this is just tau naught. This is just scaling to tau naught, actually, sorry. This is, but in the previous transparency, here, in the hydrodynamic theory, we include both terms in this plot. And you see that it doesn't fit exactly, and actually this is also something we know how to correct. There is also some another correction of higher order that I didn't go into. But anyways, the experiments are in the same ballpark as the theory. Of course, the experiment by Jörg Schmidtmeier has 2 milliseconds dephasing. When we put in their parameters, we get 4.3 milliseconds. That could be due to different reasons that this discrepancy, but we have to remember that there is many things that are unknown about the experiment. For example, what is the exact temperature in the experiment is not known. And it's probably actually fairly high temperature. So this result, our hydrodynamic 4.3 milliseconds would be low temperature. So, but at least the interesting thing is that it's in the same ballpark. So it looks like really some intrinsic and interesting dephasing mechanism is acting and not some noise in the external apparatus or in the magnetic fields, which is nice. So they're approaching the limit of interesting intrinsic processes.
I just wanted to ask, is that the only comparison that you can make with experiments? I mean, somehow so to compare dimensionful numbers seems the hardest thing.
Sure.
You think you...
Sure, parametric.
Yeah.
But they had just one experiment so far, uh-huh, which had a single temperature and a single set of parameters for... So it's... And now they're actually doing... Actually, now they're doing more experiments to compare with our... you know, our parametric dependence on the interaction strength and on temperature, it's much harder because they don't have a good thermometry. But at least from the initial results that they told us about, it seems to fit nicely with the dependence on the interaction strength. Which they can change by I think they're tuning the density, and that tunes both the density and the dimensionless interaction strength in 1D. So, I promised you one more thing, which is whether we can show that whether the hydrodynamic theory actually breaks down or not, because I use this hydrodynamic quadratic theory. And what we assume all the time, so that it will not break down, is that this phase difference across some short distance cutoff is very small compared to one, so that we can expand the cosine to quadratic order. And if this is violated during the dynamics, then it's bad. But we can calculate this thing as a function of time in the dynamics, because it's also harmonic dynamics, and actually it reaches some steady state value after a very short time, which is larger than healing length over C, and the steady state value it reaches is U over J, or actually U over T in the Hubbard model. J is the hopping in the Hubbard model. Without particle number. So if we start from a Hubbard model, this is what you will get as your value for this thing over time. So if U over J is larger than one, then we expect that the hydrodynamic theory will be violated. At least this is the expression in two dimensions, and the system will probably go into a different steady state, which we don't know. While if U over J is smaller than one, you can show that it goes to a steady state where the correlations are power law. So there might be some interesting non-equilibrium transition between exponentially decaying correlations when this U over J is larger than one, and power law correlations when this U over J is smaller than one. So it's kind of a dynamic phase transition between.
Why not say you just pumped enough energy and it's above
the constant? That's actually, so you're completely right. It's correct. The only twist here is that when you're still in the hydrodynamic theory is good and it's all harmonic, it's very hard for the system to equilibrate. So it's going into some non-equilibrium power law. So the question whether the jump in the power law will be the same or not is not completely clear to me, but going to be some jump. But
Hamiltonian populate modes thermally.
Well, why will you populate them thermally?
Well,
it's not it won't equilibrate into a thermally because it's harmonic. It's very hard for it to equilibrate. So it might equilibrate, but over a much longer time scale than you may see in the experiment. So in the experiment, you'll see some power law, which is not the thermal power law.
You did put a thermal distribution in to begin with, and you put in the analytics that you put in a quadratic distribution.
Yeah, but it's
that's definitely thermal, right? And then you know that if you talk about harmonic theory, it's thermal. I mean,
thermally remains thermal. Yeah, but it's not a distribution, it's a wave function. Is it the same as a...
the density matrix. I guess the distribution of k-modes won't be thermal, will it?
Yeah, I don't think it will. Yeah. There is one subtlety here, which, I mean, if you take it a very long time limit, I'm sure it will equilibrate, and it would just be the usual equilibrium cost. But maybe there is some very long intermediate time where you see, at least in the ordered side, I think when hydrodynamic theory is violated, clearly it will equilibrate very fast, because then the coupling between symmetric and anti-symmetric modes will be very important. And then you'll get just to the thermal exponentially decaying correlations very fast. But when it's not the case, I don't know. Then it might take it very long time to equilibrate.
Yeah. By the way, the term that you're exponent in the power minus t squared divided by t d squared.
Yes.
Of the space diffusion.
Right.
Space spreading. This time is called Berman-Zaslavsky time by nonlinear physicists, and very often it's called the Ehrenberg time.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much
it has been obtained a long time ago when you consider a nonlinear a nonlinear harmonic oscillator, or you consider an initial coherent state, yes?
Yeah.
Only one mode, yes, plus where you have H omega A dagger A.
I see.
The Hamiltonian plus the interaction term A dagger A in the square.
Okay. I see.
And then you look in the evolution, and this phenomenon they call deviation from classical behavior. Because, you know, you may map this system on the classical system, and then you compare classical and non-classical behavior. And that's what they obtained 25 or 30 years ago.
Sure.
And this term, they treat as non-classical term. It's going to the power of
E
squared by E squared.
I see. Interesting. So I the earliest paper that dealing with condensates that I cited before, actually we were out, was a paper by Leggett sometimes in the early 90s, but I don't
know. Well, you go back to that.
So
just so that we can connect what you were saying.
So, yeah. I had a transparency about this, which maybe I should have quoted actually even earlier results. I don't know, because I don't know about exact works you were talking. Wait. Yeah. So this is the transparency I quoted for the two, for this two part. So this is what I quoted. It's Leggett and Soles and Soles. Yeah. So and this is like a Josephson junction which you at some point cut in the middle, and you get this ballistic phase diffusion, and it seems like a very simple effect, because it's you just have kinetic energy after you split the Josephson junction, and this kinetic energy immediately gives you this Gaussian diffusion.
Yes, but what I'm only saying is that there is a general physical problem, which is not only related to quantum.
Oh, I see. When two paths depart from each other.
Imagine that.
I see. Okay.
You have a coherent state.
Right.
You have a nonlinear oscillator, H omega A dagger A plus G A squared.
Yeah.
Then this problem leads to this time dependence that you obtain.
I see.
And that's what has been done.
I see. Actually, it's also related, you know, to this truncated Wigner approximation. You have these many initial conditions, and this time has to do with the fact with when these different classical paths depart from each other. So it's clearly is connected. Sure.
And I just don't understand something. So my understanding that Earth has time has to do with power dynamics, and so I can imagine that people must have studied. You know, the phase diffusion of a system which is classically chaotic, which means it's non-integrable, and then Erentz time is defined as the time at which classical trajectories deviate the tangential of the system at a distance which is more than the Broglie wavelength. And
now,
as far as I understand, a system with 1 degree of freedom is always integrable. So I don't know if
this
is true. But on top of
it,
Gross-Pitayski equation is also integrable, so it's also non-chaotic.
Gross-Pitayski equation in any kind of geometry, it's going to be non-chaotic? No, I'm not sure.
In 1D. Yes.
Oh, in 1D. Oh, okay. Yeah, in 1D. Yeah.
It's purely historically that the name of Ehrenfest is attached here, yes? What people were considering is exactly the problem that I mentioned. Imagine coherent state in the Hamiltonian H omega A dagger A plus G A dagger A squared. And then you see how classical trajectories behave, yes, in this problem. And then, if you solve it more or less exactly, I don't remember how exactly it has been done, you obtain this term, minus e squared divided by e squared, which is deviation from the first equation. That's what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And, right? And the thing is that people who did this quantum, phase coherence, Dalibar and Tasten developed 10 years ago, this type of term is appearing there. And recently there was the work of Yvonne Castan and many people in the author's list who actually discussed this phase spreading or whatever in zero and find mostly finite angles. Is it something different from you? Because I looked in this paper.
What did they look at, finite temperature?
Yes, of course.
What did they look at?
They computed several correlation functions. Yes.
As a function of time?
As a function.
How they change as a function of time?
Yes. And I looked in this paper recently, yes, for whatever reason, and I would like to confess that I did not many, I didn't understand many things in that.
Whose paper?
You won't understand as one of the authors.
I don't know it, so I should look. But I, as far as I know, I mean, at least the experimentalists we talked to don't know of any paper that get, we started it because there was an experimental problem, and we don't know of any, I don't know of any other paper that treats it. But I'd be happy to learn. I mean, it's a very simple problem. I mean, I wish
you know, other even people. Even me, I have no statement in this direction. I looked at this paper, I didn't understand anything, but it's a long paper with many statements, and I was going to ask you whether you know something.
No, I don't know. I haven't seen it. By the way, okay, so that's it for now.